When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Today I'm joined by Jason Kenney. He's a Canadian Conservative politician and the former Minister of Defence in Canada, as well as being the former Minister for Immigration and Multiculturalism. We're going to be talking all about the state of Canada and conservatism in your country. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers, and I'm impressed by your podcast and your interest in Canada. Actually, normally we're ignored because people can think we're boring, but all of a sudden you've identified Canada as a place of some excitement in global political trends.
But perhaps not for the right reasons, and I want to talk about that. So I made a documentary in Canada, which I encourage everyone to go and watch, and it's called Canada, a sort of warning to the West. Do you think that Canada is a warning to other Western countries in terms of excessive liberalism?
Yes, increasingly so. And it wasn't always thus. We used to be called the Peaceable Kingdom. The preamble to our Constitution says that Canada is founded on the principles of peace, order, and good government. And I think historically, when most people think of Canada, they think of a responsible, the sort of elder daughter of the Commonwealth, with an interesting twist, which is bilingualism, and historically we called it biculturalism between the French and the English. We were also early adopters of a more formal kind of a version of British pluralism, what we started calling multiculturalism in the 1960s. But I would say that under the tenure of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau over the past 8 years or so, in addition to seeds that were planted in the academy and the media and other important cultural institutions, we now see Canada more or less in the vanguard of many of the more destructive obsessions of the left. And this is now seen in a huge increase in violent crime, often associated with an addictions crisis, I think being abetted by well-intentioned but massively wrong-headed policies. A crisis of identity in the country. A recent poll this week showed a huge decline in attachment to and pride in the country amongst younger people. A housing crisis driven in part by, I believe, irresponsibly high levels of mass immigration, and an economy in stagnation. So so much more. So that you've been covering. So I do think it's possible to say that Canada is a sort of warning sign. For other developed democracies in many respects.
Why do you think that these policies have taken place in Canada in particular?
Well, the Liberal Party of Canada, led by Justin Trudeau, was historically a broad centrist pragmatic brokerage party. A large part of its historical base were Catholics and immigrants who typically were culturally reasonably conservative. You had a lot of what we call Bay Street, or you hear in the saying this, business corporate leaders that used to support the Liberal Party as well. So it was a pretty broad, pragmatic centrist party, not really a party with deep ideological obsessions. And in that way, it reflected the fairly moderate political culture of Canada, which has historically avoided extremes on the left and right. But I would argue that, I think it's too simplistic to locate all of this in one government or one premiership. But on the political side, Justin Trudeau, I think, took over that broad pragmatic centrist party and moved it to being a party of increasingly of the left on the spectrum of issues, but particularly on sort of questions of identity. I mean, and a lot of what you have happening in Canada is happening right across the developed world, certainly across the Anglosphere, right? And much of it emanating out of the academy. I think you had, like, in the early 1970s, a large number of, when universities were expanding, there were a lot of new people hired into faculties. Many of them were American draft dodgers, quite famously avoiding the Vietnam War. And over the ensuing 20 years you had, I think, old school liberal academics increasingly hiring into their faculties younger scholars who were coming from critical studies, who were increasingly focused on aspects of what, you know, of Frankfurt School Marxism, what some call cultural Marxism. And increasingly, this went across the spectrum of the humanities and the social sciences, and now into other disciplines, where particularly in faculties of education. So I think, you know, you had this gradual capture of institutions of education by this increasingly aggressive left-wing corner of the academy. And all of these things mixed together have created the kind of momentum that you see now.
Do you think that Canadian identity has been taken over by this kind of woke or sort of left-wing ideology? And do you think that's historically because Canadian identity has been fairly weak compared to other nations? So obviously Canada is part of the Commonwealth and has a sort of past in British, in the British Empire and sort of in British colonial rule. And perhaps there are some people who argue that because of this sort of weak national foundation or national story, Canada's identity was able to be taken over by these kind of left-wing ideologues.
I think you can make that argument. I think it's a little more complex than that. But look, in the vast spectrum of the history of the British Empire, Canada was a unique experiment in some respects. The Quebec Act of the British Parliament in the mid 18th century effectively gave to the French Catholics, the former colonists of New France, it gave to them the privilege of the right to maintain their Catholic French institutions, schools, hospitals, the role of the church in civil society, civil law, etc. And so we ended up creating a confederation based on that expression of French Catholic culture in North America, alongside a more traditional sort of British colony, with of course our Indigenous peoples and First Nations, and then an openness to immigration in order to settle the West, all of which led to a very admirable, relaxed kind of a British Canadian pluralism, and we were able to reconcile those differences without worrying about it too much, and so we didn't force identity questions too hard. But I would say that this led to perhaps a bit of a, what happened in the post-war period, especially in the 60s, is that a lot of English Canadian nationalists said, we can no longer define ourselves in historical terms with reference to the British Empire, British institutions and symbols. We need to carve out our own Canadian identity. Meanwhile, in French Canada, you had the separatist movement and a deepening of national identity. A very conscious project to protect the French language and to be proud of French Canadian history. So we started to take a kind of two different approaches. And so now, yes, we I guess because Justin Trudeau famously said, or infamously said, the year he became prime minister, that Canada is the world's first post-national state. We have no national identity. But since then, he has effectively also accused the country of not only historical, but active and current genocide. He lowered our country's flag at all federal institutions for over half a year as an expression of collective guilt for some of the injustices that happened to First Nations people. So is it at all surprising that we now see reflected in current polling a dramatic drop in attachment to and pride in the country? I don't think so.
You talk about the Quebec Act. Just interesting thing about that, of course, that led to some American revolutionaries leading to the formation of
it's
the United
true.
States.
In fact, I would say the fairly enlightened British approach, both to in historical terms, in historical context, to the preservation of French Catholic institutions, but also the Royal Proclamation, which in an historical context was far more generous towards indigenous people than what the Americans were doing south of the border. So the U.S., the American Revolution was prompted in part by what they saw as excessive British generosity towards those racial minorities, the First Nations Indigenous people, and also the Quebecers. So, and Canada was also, I mean, so Canada was founded by refugees from the American Revolution, right? Who were willing to embrace those things, and unsurprisingly, we were also the North Star, the Underground Railroad for escaped slaves, who came from the American colonies. So I think in many respects, there's so much to be proud of, even from a liberal perspective, of the role that Canada played in our history as a place of pluralism, protect and respect for human dignity. Imperfectly.
There's also a misconception, I think, about Canada as being this very historically polite and almost soft nation in a way, whereas the original Canadians, they were some of the toughest frontier men that you could have. Yeah. And of course, one of the great Canadian heroes, I think, is John A. Macdonald, your first Prime Minister. And when we made this documentary in Canada over the summer, we went to his statue in Toronto, which has been boarded up for fear of being attacked, and perhaps the statue will even be removed. The decision hasn't been made yet. So I'm just curious to hear your thoughts about these kind of attacks on Canadian history, and particularly these attacks on Canada's past connection with Britain and the British Empire. What do you think is the impact of that?
Yeah, well, look, obviously the more virulent and recent expressions of this are informed by the increasingly zealous academic obsession with anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism, critical race theory, intersectionality, all stirred together in the stew of what we call wokeism. And it's an unapologetic effort to efface much of our history. I will say there's a certain selectivity being applied, which suggests actually, at some level, this is almost a partisan project. For example, John Macdonald, there's absolutely no question. Without John Macdonald, there'd be no Canada. And his liberal, most recent biographer of John Macdonald, Richard Gwynne, was a fan of Pierre Trudeau. He was very much a liberal academic and journalist. And he says, no Macdonald, no Canada. He was a guy who took the warring factions of the Orange and Green Irish, of Protestants and Catholics, of French and British, of the First Nations, and somehow carved this huge, vast country under pressure from American aggression across North America. It was one of the great achievements of statesmanship of the 19th century. And we can acknowledge that and honor his central role in our founding, while at the same time recognizing that obviously in historical retrospect, there were great injustices and prejudices of that time, including prejudices towards Indigenous people, which did lead to injustice. And we have to be frank about that. My view as a conservative is that we have to both celebrate what's best about our history, but also be clear-minded about what's worst in it. But it seems that the huge push from the cultural left is to look at Canada as an unmitigated, and this is kind of a theme almost amplified by Prime Minister Trudeau, to look at our history as one of almost unmitigated and gross injustice, or as he would say, genocide. And as I say, this is applied selectively. For example, the first French Canadian Prime Minister, Sir Wilfrid Laurier, who was a great Liberal Prime Minister. In fact, the major donor club of Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party is called the Laurier Club to this day. He massively expanded the Indian residential school system. He signed an order in council banning blacks from migrating to Canada. He brought in the continuous journey policy that effectively made it impossible for South Asians to immigrate to Canada, leading to the Komagato-Maru incident. He increased by tenfold the Chinese head tax, which was a bigoted anti-Chinese immigration policy. And somehow his statues are standing all across the country. So I do think there is a kind of selectivity in it. And this is one of the problems with this kind of historical revisionism. It's never applied consistently. Not that it should be. In terms of the cancel culture.
We're currently at ARC in Greenwich in London, and just a couple of miles away in Greenwich Park, there is a statue to a, I think, a great Canadian hero, James Wolfe, who I don't know if you've seen it, but who won his brilliant battles in Quebec. But that was just a side note. I want to ask about Christianity in Canada, and I know that there are some people who say Canada has become a real sort of post-Christian nation. Do you agree with that thesis?
Well, yes, I think that's a fair diagnosis of most Western countries with deep Christian histories. We're down to, I think, something like 15% weekly church attendance. A majority of the population still registers as Christian. And so, there's still that sort of attenuated cultural influence of a much more robust Christian society in the past. I would say that, this is particularly the case in Quebec. In Quebec, which was 70 years ago a deeply Catholic, historically agrarian society where the church was embedded in every institution, Quebec in the mid-1960s went through a period called the Quiet Revolution, where essentially a new secular nationalist government said that the church should be removed from the administration of schools and hospitals, welfare programs, and so on. At the same time, you had modern communications and lots of demographic changes, urbanization. And it almost overnight, you had a perhaps the single fastest secularization of a society in the modern era. And so young Quebecers have very little historical memory of or even connection to that past, which is challenging because it's hard to identify French Canadian or Quebec history and identity out of that historical Catholic context.
You talk about Quebec. Let's talk about Alberta. You were the premier of Alberta during the coronavirus pandemic. And just sticking on this theme of Christianity, there were some videos during the coronavirus lockdowns of priests in Alberta coming up against the law because of lockdown restrictions in churches. Do you have any regrets as the premier of Alberta in terms of those lockdown policies and how it impacted the church?
Well, actually, Alberta had the lightest restrictions of any province, and that would be, I think, universally acknowledged. I was the premier at the time and widely condemned by most of the mainstream media and my political adversaries for being, they would claim, recklessly liberal on COVID restrictions. We were the only province to allow for congregational worship to continue throughout the entire pandemic. Some other provinces shut all places of worship for months at a time. And we were in constant communication with faith leaders about how to get it right. I don't regret the policies that we had because we have in our single-payer healthcare system, a ration system with very limited capacity. And we came a couple of times perilously close to having to triage patients, deny people care, withdraw care from others. And we did at times have to cancel half or more of the surgeries to repurpose surgical staff into intensive care. I found the vast majority of Christian and other faith leaders understood that we had to be prudent. And it was very obvious that I was struggling with the how to do that with the limited damage of restrictions. In I think two or three instances, there were pastors, not priests, but all of them were evangelical, independent evangelical pastors, who very flagrantly, publicly, repeatedly for months refused any communication with the public health authorities and just ignored all of the measures. No, you know, they just told the people not to wear masks and to jam in next to each other and so forth. And eventually, the enforcement authorities got court injunctions against those two or three churches. I do regret that all of that happened, but if they had acted more, I think, in my perspective, more responsibly, it could have been avoided.
Do you think that Canadian conservatives in general have been too weak in pushing back against this excessive liberalism, not just over the last few years, but, I mean, going back sort of decades?
Yeah, I think in retrospect, you could make that argument. Although there have been, you know, when I was Minister of Citizenship, Immigration, and Multiculturalism, I very clearly tried to change the debate to focus on a kind of a positive approach to pluralism, where people can have a healthy pride in their cultural antecedents, their faith and customs, while becoming fully Canadian. I used to quote David Cameron saying Tony Blair, excuse me. Better cut that one.
Very similar people. So
yeah. I used to quote Tony Blair saying that the host society has a duty to be welcoming and newcomers have a duty to integrate. And there's all sorts of ways I express that in policy, including increasing the duration required for people to get citizenship, increasing the threshold for civic literacy, a much clearer presentation of Canadian identity and history in our citizenship test. We changed the multiculturalism program to focus on building bridges in advance at promoting civic literacy and integration into Canada. We did a lot of practical things. I was widely criticized by many on the left for these things. But the problem is, when you're focused on the political side, there's always going to be a change of government, and any policies like these can, in this case, were reversed by the Trudeau government. So I'm a strong believer in the premise that politics is downstream of culture, and if you want to have an enduring effect on counteracting some of these more radical trends, it has to come from, before it becomes political, it has to come from cultural institutions. And I think that's where conservative-minded people, or just mainstream people broadly, haven't understood the stakes. I'll give you an example. We have these local school boards elected across Canada. Typically, the turnout, the voter participation is like 15, certainly under 20%. Well, it just so happens that the teachers' unions and their ideological allies completely dominate these elections and are, you know, radically removed from the sort of centrist political consensus in Canada. So I would say if you want to reverse some of these more extreme trends, it's going to require severely normal middle class families actually getting engaged at the local level in local decision making.
Around the world, conservative movements have changed, and I would say that conservatism as a sort of mainstream philosophy across Western countries and across political parties in the West has become more radical in recent years, particularly in response to some of the kind of woke revolutionaries that we've seen and some of the woke policies, etc. And that's obviously happened in Canada, as you've said, to a large extent. Do you think that Canadian conservatives have adapted to this new era of conservatism?
No, I think they're still struggling. But look, on the political level, responsible political leaders have to deal with the imminent priorities of the broad public. And right now in Canada, that's cost of living, it's housing, it's a bundle of very practical issues. My former intern, a conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, is doing a very good job of that. And by the way, I think here's my point. Engaging in sort of theoretical, ideological struggle is not a path to government. You have to focus, and I think Stephen Harper was brilliant at this. You have to focus on concrete concerns of regular people and their aspirations. It just so happens that what Pierre Poilievre is focused on, cost of living, housing, etc., much of it is the problem is the consequence of unrealistic ideological zeal by Trudeau and the left. For example, bidding up the price of energy in an energy-rich and abundant country. We have the third largest oil reserves in the world, the fifth largest natural gas reserves. He effectively has a series of policies trying to massively constrain those industries to make energy massively more expensive for people in an energy-rich country. It makes no sense. So, but the way to win that debate isn't, I think, on the level of political theory. It's by focusing on the concrete costs to destructive policies like that. On the question of for example, legitimization of dangerous drug addictions, and this what started as a well-intentioned focus on so-called harm reduction is now transformed into the agents of the government actually handing out a dangerous, illicit, toxic drugs to people. And now that that's affecting the mainstream population in terms of violent crime and social disorder in many of our cities, that's become a retail political issue. So I think leaders are right to focus on how these problems intersect with the lives of regular people.
I think you're so right on that, but also at the same time, these culture wars are going on within many institutions, and as we've talked about, Canadian history, for example, is under attack. And if one completely ignores this, then the other side simply wins.
No, I agree.
And one issue I want to mention specifically about where perhaps Canadian Conservatives, I think, have kind of dropped the ball, is on so-called kind of gender transitioning, gender conversion therapy. And there was a Bill C-4 in the Canadian Parliament that many Conservatives voted for that banned gender conversion therapy for so-called gender identities. In other words, it might have banned parents telling their children, you're not trans, although you may think you are, you're just gay, or you're confused, or you have gender dysphoria. So that's one issue where it just seems so odd to me that the conservative MPs in the Canadian Parliament would vote in favour of that bill. Do you agree with me that that's perhaps a kind of blind spot in Pierre Poilievre's Conservative Party on this transgender issue?
Well, more recently, he expressed support for the concerns raised by parents in a series of large protests across the country, that at the very least parents have a right to know what's going on in the most critical decisions of their children's lives, because we have I can only refer to my own record on these issues. I succeeded a socialist government in Alberta, NDP government, that had made it illegal for schools to communicate with parents on these issues. And I ran on a platform to repeal this. Now, my policy.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Of communicating with parents if their children were going through some gender dysphoria or another identity crisis was somehow going to kill children. I mean, they accused me of purposely wanting children, gender diverse children, to die. This is, and of course, so we changed the law. There hasn't been any negative consequence from that. So I do think, you know, and by the way, there were people in my own campaign, in my own party, that came to me and said, you're being politically reckless. You're risking our election by taking such a apparently strident position of informing parents, of allowing teachers to inform parents about some of these issues. You have to reverse course on this. I refuse to do so. And we won the largest number of votes in Alberta political history. So I do think that political leaders need, on issues like this, these are difficult, emotionally wrought issues. You have to be clear about what your motive is. You have to be deliberate and careful, but you can also be courageous in standing up to the mob of the left, which is trying in this instance to completely disempower parents from critical decisions affecting their kids.
Politics is one thing, but morality is surely more important. And if an issue is right or wrong, then that's what matters, I suppose. And I know that as a politician, you have to take into account all of these different considerations in terms of strategy, etc. But on this issue of such an important issue of parental rights, of allowing children to be able to, or allowing parents to have proper communication with their parents, I think it just seems to me that's a really clear-cut issue, and nothing else matters. But I don't know.
And it's interesting, in the Canadian context, as you've seen, there's this huge multi-ethnic coalition building on this, because immigrant, broadly speaking, immigrant parents, one thing they're not going to sacrifice is their responsibility for their kids.
And this is something so interesting. We interviewed a Sikh guy, Sikh family, actually, in this documentary we made in Canada, and he was very much against what he described as the militarization of the sexualization of children in Canada. And he described, for example, he has an 8-year-old son who was told that he should dress up in the opposite gender's clothing for some sort of drag day in school. And he took the kid out of school and he told us, look, the school likes to promote my multicultural background when they're talking about South Asian Heritage Day, and they like me making curries, but when I say my opinions on important issues of LGBT rights, for example, they don't want to listen to me, and it's a very and suddenly he's become a kind of outcast in the school among many parents and teachers and things like this. And so perhaps there's an interesting phenomenon, isn't there,
that authentic pluralism has to include respect for a diversity of belief, not just sort of the external trappings of cultural diversity. And increasingly, I think we see on the left a total intolerance for a diversity of belief.
I want to talk about multiculturalism, and this is such an interesting topic, particularly today, after the protests we've seen across the Western world, but particularly in Canada, pro-Palestinian protests following this terrible murder of Jews in Israel by Hamas. Do you think that is a sign that multiculturalism in Canada is failing?
I would say that not necessarily. I don't look at this as a multicultural issue. You can look at the crowds and, well, 2 weeks ago, I was walking into a national conference on anti-Semitism that was planned long before the Hamas atrocities. And as I was approaching the doors of the Ottawa Congress Center, a small group of protesters saw me coming. They banded together, blocked the doors, locked arms, and wouldn't let me come in. And I scanned the group. They all looked to me like pretty typical middle-class Caucasian Canadian kids whose minds undoubtedly had been poisoned by obsessive and distorted obsession with anti-colonial, anti-imperialism, critical race theory at whatever universities they go to. So that's not about multiculturalism. That's about a totally different challenge, which is that this capture of entire sections of the academy, which are effectively indoctrinating large numbers of young people of all backgrounds, of all cultural and ethnic backgrounds, into this ideology. So I would say, like in London here, a very substantial portion of those crowds who are energetically anti-Israel they're very diverse crowds, and they include people whose families have been in Canada or Britain for centuries.
But undoubtedly, many of these protesters, some of which are outrightly pro-Hamas, come from Muslim countries, come from Muslim backgrounds, And I think that many Canadians, and particularly in Britain, I'm talking about the British context here, would say that this is something a little bit to do with multiculturalism, because we've imported many, many people who support a terrorist organization, and that is Hamas. And in France, for example, the French Minister of the Interior has talked about deporting people who support this organization who aren't French citizens. Do you think that that could be a policy that Canada could adopt?
Well, I was a member of a government that adopted a policy of revoking citizenship from dual nationals who had been convicted of engaging in terrorism, and that would include, for example, fundraising for terrorist organizations. We also, the Harper government, brought in a law that's been repealed to ban glorification of terrorism. And I think some of the elements of some of these protests would clearly meet that legal threshold of glorifying Hamas. but interesting English note, British note, when I was Minister of Citizenship and Immigration, I refused to grant a ministerial permit to allow the admission into Canada of George Galloway because he had handed tens of thousands of euros in cash to Ismail Haniyeh in Gaza City, and was thereby funding a banned terrorist entity. I also wrote into the Citizenship Guide of Canada that Canada's tolerance and diversity does not extend to supporting violent foreign conflicts. So I think there's all sorts of things that can and must be done by Western societies to lay out clear markers. Look, the reality is there is a real dynamic tension between legitimate freedom of expression and crossing the line into actually supporting illicit terrorism. And let's not pretend that's an easy line to draw. In some cases, people are straddling the fence on that, aren't they?
Do you think that some people are impossible to integrate into Canadian society?
I think that in any society, there are people who are going to commit crimes, and they should be held accountable regardless of their
background. But I'm not talking about crimes necessarily, but in terms of Canadian culture and supporting Canadian values and becoming a Canadian in that sense. They might not necessarily have to be a criminal to not be able to become a Canadian, if you see what I mean.
Well, I would say, look, integration rarely happens upon arrival, but the vast majority of people, like integration is a process. The vast majority of people who come to Canada do not come there in order just to reconstruct their country of origin. They come to become Canadian, and they know perhaps just implicitly and intuitively that they're coming to a country with a certain set of values, historically grounded institutions and customs that have made it a desirable place in which to live. A tradition of ordered liberty, of a rule of law, parliamentary government, of property rights, of a free market. So I think the vast majority of people want to be a part of that. They're eager. I can tell you, for example, if you look at the cadets, which are the programs for teenagers to do to join auxiliaries of the various branches of the military, do community service, and wear uniforms and learn military drill. Overwhelmingly, I would say well over two-thirds of them are the children of immigrants as an expression of their patriotism for the new country. So I think that's the vast majority. But you know, I think all through our history, there have been a minority who are perhaps much more reluctant. I have to hasten to add, this is not entirely a new problem. The number one challenge in English Canada in much of the 19th century was Irish Catholics versus Irish loyalists fighting out the old country struggle on the streets of Toronto and the farm towns of Upper Canada. So these are not entirely new challenges.
No, and as you say, there have been inter-ethnic conflicts throughout history among different groups. And in the UK, I don't know about the Canadian context more recently, but in the UK, in Leicester, there have been race riots between the kind of Hindus and the Muslims from Pakistan and India. Again, bringing those conflicts from their countries into Britain, and I think that's an example, again, of where multiculturalism hasn't worked and those people haven't integrated into British society. And I know at the beginning of this interview you said that immigration into Canada is too high. You think the numbers are too high. Why do you think that?
Because we just on a very practical level, we don't have housing for people, let alone sufficient space in the healthcare system for effectively 1.5 million people a year on a population of 38 or 40 million.
So it's not an issue of integration, it's an issue of economics.
Well, I also think, look, my view is, and I said this for 5 years as Canada's Minister of Immigration, that we're an open and welcoming country. I'm glad that we have a broadly pro-immigration political consensus, but we can't take that for granted. We need public support for immigration, including amongst immigrants, is predicated on immigration working for the country and for newcomers, and by which I mean that the successful social and economic integration of folks. They now have a annual target of 500,000 permanent residents, but that obscures the fact that there are close to another million temporary foreign workers and foreign students coming in the midst of a housing crisis and a crisis of access to our healthcare system. I think it's irresponsible to maintain those levels. And I say this as somebody who in any other country would be considered somebody who supports fairly high levels of immigration. So I think they're risking the pro-immigration consensus. And yes, integration is one of these factors. It one of the concerning issues I think we have, if we're honest in Canada, is deepening ethnic enclaves. That is to say, people tending to move into neighborhoods with largely populations from the same country or region of origin. And my concern is that actually can end up, there's a lot of social support in that. There's some good aspects in it. There's social capital and people, you know, get practical support, employment, housing with relatives and friends. But it can also retard the linguistic and economic and then social integration of people. I mean, if you're a kid whose parents have immigrated from mainland China and you're going to a school where 90% or more of your classmates have Mandarin as their first language, I suspect it's going to take you longer to learn English, and that may hold you back in the economy. So these are things we need to be willing to discuss openly, but there really isn't a debate like that in Canada.
But also for the Canadians who are already there, if your children are in that 10% of people who don't speak Chinese or aren't from a Chinese background, that can also cause tensions and problems. And I think, again, we've seen that in Britain where, you know, whole communities have been taken over by people from other cultures and other backgrounds, and they've suddenly become a minority in their own area. And I think that can cause ethnic problems and tensions, and it has, undoubtedly, I think. Do you think that diversity is a strength?
I think it can be, but just reciting that, you know, that bromide, diversity is our greatest strength, I think missed the point. I think our greatest strength in societies like the United Kingdom and Canada is our tradition of ordered liberty. Diversity is a product of that. People want to come to our countries because of the historically grounded institutions, customs, and principles that we're blessed to have. And so, I mean, I don't think we should turn diversity into this sort of cult. I think we should celebrate the positive aspects of it, recognize that in increasingly diverse societies, there are also going to be tensions and challenges. It shouldn't be verboten to talk openly about those challenges. We should also, I don't like to overstate those challenges, because broadly speaking, these are pretty successful societies, we need to be intentional about keeping it that way.
Donald Trump is obviously back on the political scene in America, in Canada's southern neighbor, and he has become a political phenomenon over there. How do Canadian conservatives deal with Donald Trump?
Well, you know, first of all, just on a very practical issue, he's a huge protectionist, and our economies are so integrated that's a constant challenge and threat to us. Tearing up NAFTA was an existential threat to our economy, for example, and we finally negotiated a second version of it with minor changes. It also creates for any of America's friends a kind of unpredictability in international affairs and in strategic and defense policy, for example. But as a conservative, my own view on this is that his brand of weaponizing populist anger with no kind of governing conservative principles that are discernible to me is toxic and poses an existential threat to anything that could properly be called the conservative movement. I think much of his appeal to people is not based on any policies or principles per se, but on a kind of on the stylistic approach of Donald Trump as his willingness to be vulgar and insult the cultural elites, the cultural and political and economic elites, which a large segment of the Republican electorate so deeply despises. I don't think that is a, you know, I think if that becomes the face of conservatism in the Western world, then it's a movement that does not deserve to be in government. I think it's massively destructive. It has nothing to do with the sort of Burkean conception of learning from the past, preserving what's best about our institutions and customs. It's all about burning things down. As he says, I am your revenge. You know, anger and revenge do not constitute an appealing political vision, in my view.
Do you worry about populism?
I worry about the more extreme versions of it like that. I mean, I've been called a populist in the Canadian context, but that by which I think my opponents mean, I was simply willing to give space to the anxieties of ordinary people against the elite consensus on things like carbon taxes, for example, or aspects of the debate around integration. So I do think that a marriage can be found between sort of traditional conservatism and aspects of populism. But I think Trump represents something else altogether.
I want to end the interview by talking about Canada's euthanasia laws. This was another topic that we explored in our documentary in Canada. In Canada, they call them MAID laws, right? So sort of medical assisted in dying. Do you think that the expansion of those laws to include mental illness as a category next year for people to be able to have assisted suicide, is that a concern for you?
Deeply. I helped to lead the fight against the legalization of euthanasia in Canada for over 20 years in Parliament. We successfully voted down during that time several private members' bills to legalize it. And the Supreme Court of Canada, which was massively empowered by the Charter of Rights in 1982, upheld the law against banning assisted suicide or euthanasia 15 years ago. But at the end of the Harper government 8 years ago, they did a complete inversion on that decision and essentially imposed it on Parliament. And ever since, the Trudeau government has sought increasingly to widen the statutory provisions for so-called medical assistance in dying. And it's now reaching like a dystopian level. We used to point to the excesses in Belgium and Holland as a cautionary tale, but it's now Canada that's become that with a pending expansion of the law to allow for so-called mature minors, which implies without parental consent, and for people with mental illness, and now to people with drug addictions. So literally, the policy direction is to euthanize, to offer euthanasia as an alternative to people to addictions. It's reached such a disgusting point that we had veterans seeking service from the Veterans Affairs Department calling up frustrated caseworkers who would say, have you ever considered applying for medical assistance in dying? Veterans being referred by state bureaucrats to euthanasia to quote, solve their case challenges. I think of all of the excesses of the Trudeau era, this is the most abhorrent.
We interviewed Christine Gaultier, the veteran. You mentioned her case where she was asking for a disabled ramp in her home in Montreal, and the caseworker said, have you considered MAID, or basically, have you considered killing yourself? How has that happened in Canada? I mean, I just don't understand. It seems so immoral to me. Is it a Trudeau thing, or is it a broader...
You know, there's always been a fairly high level of public support. Even when we were voting it down in Parliament, I must admit, there was a fairly high level of public support for the principle of medical assistance in dying that was that was supposed to be narrowly circumscribed. And I think that's just a reflection of sort of the modern liberal priority on personal autonomy and people's fear that they might end up in a with irremediable pain. I think part of the problem here is that the medical community and other leaders have done a poor job of describing the huge advances in palliative care and the ability to die, yes, with dignity, with appropriate medical support. So I think governments need massively to increase support for and awareness of the life-giving option of palliative care. But I don't think any Canadians really, or very few, thought they were signing up for euthanizing children, minors, drug addicts, and this kind of, it's now, what is it? I think the third highest cause of death in Canada.
I think 5% of all deaths were from medical.
So I really don't think this is what that broad public that was concerned about extreme cases were thought they were signing up for several years ago.
You describe the policy as dystopian. Again, do you link this to Canada's the decline in Christianity in Canada, or is it something else? Is it secularism that's caused this?
Yeah, it obviously the prioritization of radical personal autonomy over a conception of the human being as having possessing an inviolable dignity created in the image of God, which is common to at least all of the Abrahamic faiths. I think that's a common spiritual and trend, which has moral and then therefore policy consequences. But I wouldn't just situate this in Christian terms, because you know there are, as our country becomes, as Canada becomes more diverse, there are people from all of the different growing faith traditions who have serious moral concerns about this.
One last topic I want to ask about is, in Canada there's no abortion laws, and again this is also being criticised by many socially conservative Canadians, including Maxime Bernier, leader of a party in Canada, and some Christians as well. So what do you make of this? It's quite excessive, the fact that Canada has no laws regulating abortion.
There is a misconception that that's the result of a Supreme Court decision, when in fact the court decision on this in 1988 openly invited Parliament to come back with some parameters. And there were a couple of failed efforts to do so in the late 1980s. Look, I was very open in my 25 years in public life about my pro-life conviction. And it does concern me that Canada is, I believe, the only Western democracy with no effort in law to assign any value at any stage to the lives of unborn children. Given that we are Canada historically was a place of sort of political moderation on certain issues like this, our actual a policy setting has been objectively immoderate. We've been a huge outlier, I would say, in the democratic world. Here in Europe, most countries have limits around 12 or 16 weeks and for different conditions, recognizing, maybe not my view, that there's about the inviolable sanctity of the human person at all stages, but certainly recognizing there's some state interest in protecting vulnerable unborn human life, and yet it's become almost impossible to have that debate in the Canadian context. I mean, anytime somebody in Parliament even brings up a bill, for example, to make it a criminal penalty to assault a woman with the intention of harming their unborn child or compelling a woman to have an abortion, even these bills that have been proposed have been massively mischaracterized by the Trudeau Liberals and many in the media. So it's become almost impossible to have a kind of debate which is normal in Westminster or in France or in Scandinavia, for that matter.
What do you think that says about the state of Canadian morality?
I think it says that that we've gone from a country with a political culture of consensus and moderation to one where there are certain issues that have been completely read out of democratic debate. And I don't think that's... I think at one level that's profoundly illiberal, actually.
Thank you very much, Jason Kenny, for joining us. Really, cheers. Appreciate your time. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this show and are interested in hearing more episodes like it, please follow this podcast and drop us a review. If you have any suggestions of people you would like to be interviewed, you can let us know via the Apple Podcasts app.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.